Hi, and welcome to the Cutaneous Connection, a podcast from the staff at Dermatology Times, aiming to provide you with the latest updates in dermatology, to exclusive interviews with leading industry experts, and a glimpse of what goes on behind the scenes. I'm your host, Morgan Petronelli. This week's podcast will take a look back on some of the latest news and research coming out of the American Academy of Dermatology Virtual Meeting Experience 2021 by featuring interviews with two KOLs about various topics. Let's dive right in. The first interview we're highlighting is with Dr. Misha Rosenbach, Associate Professor of Dermatology and Residency Program Director at the University of Pennsylvania, located in Philadelphia. In this exclusive interview, Dr. Rosenbach sits down with Dermatology Times to discuss his presentation at AAD VMX 2021 about climate change in dermatology, including how climate change is affecting dermatology, what kinds of skin manifestations are on the rise, and what dermatologists can do to help.
What would you say are like the biggest issues right now facing dermatology in relation to climate change? What would you say are like the top hurdles?
So I think there's two ways to answer that question. So one is like, hey, if you're a dermatologist consuming content, what do you need to know from a patient standpoint about like, how will dermatologists change what you're seeing in your practice? And so getting back to actually that longer season answer, So I'm in Philadelphia, which is like the Lyme capital, like Pennsylvania is like the Lyme capital of the world, really. So we're used to seeing Lyme, but we're used to seeing Lyme in like, you know, June, July, August, September, whatever. But because of mild winters and nicer environment for ticks and their like little nymph larva baby ticks to do stuff, you can get biting earlier. So now we can see Lyme in like March, when we would never see it then. But that's okay, because I know what Lyme looks like. But what we also see is that as temperatures are warming, things like the tick and its dear host are moving into new habitats. So as it gets warmer here, it's getting warmer farther north, so then they can live farther north. And so now we have dermatologists in places like Maine or Canada that their whole career never saw Lyme disease, but now they're having Lyme disease because of climate change. So like we know with Lyme, if you recognize it early and you give antibiotics, you can, you know, fix it. But if you miss a diagnosis of Lyme, you can have really profound secondary or disseminated or potentially long-term issues from untreated Lyme. And dermatologists who are not aware of changing patterns of disease in response to climate change are going to miss diagnoses and not serve their patients and potentially expose themselves to medical legal issues, but you know, worse patient outcomes. And so when I say that there's like this fungus, this coccidioidomycosis fungus, we called it valley fever. It's like from the Southwest US. But because of persistent prolonged droughts across the whole like West Coast, it can now be found as far north as Washington. And so again, if you think about like tropical illnesses in Texas or desert illnesses from Arizona now in Washington or tick-borne illnesses from Pennsylvania now in Canada, those are all doctors who aren't familiar with or expecting to see it and they're seeing it and dealing with it. But I mean, from a broader question, you know, climate change is affecting everyone right now. And so if you worry about a refugee crisis, there are people displaced from their homes because of human-induced fossil fuels leading to warmer air, leading to changing patterns of weather where, you know, we see like the Arctic cold blob come down, but in other places there's persistent drought and they can't farm, their lakes dry up, then they have to move. So like the conflict in Syria, there are like multiple papers now showing that due to persistent drought in rural areas of Syria, the farmers moved into cities and that led to unrest and that led to like the civil war. And then that's like, that's directly affected us, right? Like that's like the rise of ISIS is from climate change. No, that's not like the soundbite I want in an article, but like we know that there are forced migrations in response to people not being able to feed and protect and take care of their family. Extreme weather events, like we pay attention here. But if, you know, if I say Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Maria or Hurricane Irma or like, or, you know, Hurricane Sandy, you know, you can name all of these things. And it's not like there were not climate, there were not hurricanes 100 years ago. But we know from hotter air and hotter waters that fuels more powerful, more potent hurricanes that can hold more water. and they tend to move slower. So they dump much more water. So that's why Hurricane Harvey in Houston was so damaging, or Hurricane Maria across, you know, Puerto Rico was so strong. Those are impacts of climate change. So climate change made those more frequent and worse. There were nine hurricanes, major hurricanes, that made landfall in the U.S. last year. And that's because of climate change making them more severe.
Have you personally seen the effects of climate change on the skin? You know, what kind of manifestations are occurring? You know, are there certain manifestations only occurring in specific areas like we kind of talked about earlier?
So I think it's one of these things that most people would say no. The truth is, I would say, like, it depends what you mean by that. And so for me, one of the reasons I got interested in this is I for many years directed the inpatient consult service here at Penn. And we saw an adult patient who had hand, foot, and mouth disease, which is a Coxsackie infection. Hand, foot, and mouth usually happens in kids. I was like, oh, it's weird. I didn't even think we'd see this in adults. That's pretty uncommon. And then we saw two or three more adults with it. And I was like, wow, this is weird. And we presented them at conference. And one of my ID colleagues was like, oh, yeah, this is from climate change. I was like, oh, what do you mean? And it's like, well, it was, you know, there's this theory that as there's like more mild winters and temperatures don't drop down cold enough, that we're going to see some persistence of this virus and allow it to mutate and cause different things in different populations. And some of that is true and some of that's not. But in looking into it, a lot of this data came from China, where hand, foot, and mouth disease is a reportable illness, and they basically like track it. And it turns out that there are like humidity and temperature variables. And now there have been other studies that show that, like, yeah, as it gets more humid and hot from climate change, you might see more of this like viral infection. So, like, I know this because I've looked into it and read about it. But if, you know, there's plenty of other dermatologists who saw an adult with hand, foot, and mouth disease, they're not going to say, like, oh, that's from climate change. Or again, like, if I diagnose someone with Lyme in April, is that from climate change? Or is that just, oh, it happened to be a hungry early tick that happened to get them? And so I think it becomes hard. It's sort of like with the hurricanes, where there were hurricanes before we released fossil fuels and warmed the planet. But now we know that there are more of them and they're more severe. And so, like, you know, if you look at how many cases of Lyme we diagnose here now versus 20 years ago when I started my career, it's gone up quite a bit. That's a result of climate change. But like each individual tick bite is not like, oh, this one is the climate one and that one is the just normal one. And so I do think it becomes tricky to like pinpoint. And that's one reason I think people have a hard time wrapping their minds around it. But along that line, though, I one of the things that's important is, you know, the Earth has been here for billions of years. And if you look at the data we have from direct measurements of CO2 in the air or from ice core analysis, we know how quickly things have changed or what levels of CO2 there have been in the past. But we know that on a thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of years scale also. And so what we see now is that not only are there now 420 parts per million of CO2 in the air, whereas pre-industrial, there was about 280. So it's gone up by about 50% in 100 years. But that's hard. It's like, well, what does 280 mean? What does 420 mean? But in the entire human existence, we've never had this much CO2 in the air. And it's not like it has an instant effect. It's like a blanket that we've wrapped around the Earth that stays there. So every day there's more heat trapped than there would have been had we not emitted all this CO2. But that changes things on a rapid scale, but not on like a human memory scale. So if I say, oh, when I was a kid, there were 20 snow days, and now my kids have like 2 snow days, that's a difference. It's insane that we can observe things like that on a single human's lifetime when we're talking about geological scales. And even with that, I have never in my entire life experienced an average temperature year, and you have not ever experienced an average temperature year. So even if you're like, oh, I think it's getting hotter, that's crazy, because like you have no, like we shouldn't be doing this on a human frame of reference. We should be doing this on like a thousands of years timeline. And so the fact that I can say, yes, I've observed changes from climate change, that's like should be truly terrifying for people.
How do you think climate change will affect the incidence of skin diseases over the course of the next decade? Do you think a certain region will be more affected than others?
I think, so this is the American Academy of Dermatology and Derm Times, and we're in America. And so we tend to have a very like North American centric view of things. If you look at like the net amount of carbon emissions, the US is responsible for more than any other country. The climate impacts will be much bigger on smaller and poorer countries and equatorial countries. And so if I'm going to start saying what I think in America, honestly, the biggest thing is probably going to be more storms and displacement of, you know, people in like Bangladesh and Micronesia and you know, Pacific Island nations that will be underwater. And like Lake Chad persistent drought and conflict that will arise from that. Like that's not really dermatological stuff. So like for me, like infections are the easiest thing to point to because they're so understandable how it's related to climate change. The truth is there's a lot that we need to learn about skin cancer. And you know, it might be that that's a pretty common problem. And imagine that pretty common problem goes up by 1%. Well, then you take a common problem and you increase it by even a small amount, it becomes like a bigger problem. And so like, you know, I can talk about tropical illnesses, but I think there's just a lot of unknown things out there, but I would like to flip it around and be like, let's not find out. So like, there are scary things out there where there are papers that look at like long dead and buried or long buried or frozen viruses or bacteria or fungus in like the permafrost in around the Arctic Circle that now as that's thawing, like melt and are re-exposed and still able to cause infection. And like, I really hope the biggest problem we have is more skin cancer. I hope it's not that some like mass grave of smallpox melts out and then some farmer stumbles on it and like that's a new global pandemic of terrifying proportions. But you know, I think we know enough to know that we don't want to find out. And I'm hoping that we make good decisions over the next 10 years. So I feel like these talks tend to be very doom and gloom, like, oh my gosh, bad stuff's happening. Like the cheapest energy you can get right now is solar and wind. And the cheapest energy you can build right now is solar and wind. There is no reason we should not just be massively building solar and wind and geothermal, and we could make infinite free energy and supply it like across the world. And it could be like a humanitarian magical transformative moment and give everyone work to do and free energy. You know, no one should ever have to pay an energy bill. Everyone should have free internet. Like it's not like a crazy socialist view. It's like this is the technology exists that we can install things that we know will protect the world now and for thousands of generations. It would be awful not to make the right choices.
So I have one last question for you here. You know, what are some ways the medical community can help in the fight against climate change? You know, and how can they encourage their patients to do the same?
So talking about it matters. So no, it shouldn't be a third rail that people are afraid to bring up. Reading and learning about it so that you're informed, so that you can recognize when things are directly happening matters. But we don't want to see the worst effects. We want to take early action and stave off the worst effects. And so the ways that we do that are with following science. So people should support people who follow science. And that can mean donations, that can mean voting at all and different levels. There are real movements underway talking about things like divestment, like divesting from fossil fuels. So, you know, if you have a retirement account, so I can choose to bring a, you know, reusable bag to the grocery store. And that will save like, you know, a few plastic bags. Or I could choose to have the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology come not wrapped in plastic. That will save 13,000 plastic bags per month. So if you can change organizations at a larger level, you can have like a more magnified impact. So, you know, should every dermatologist like buy a Tesla or an electrical vehicle? I mean, yes, probably. But if you're charging it at a power station that still gets coal energy, it's not going to have quite as much of a beneficial impact as if you lobby your state and local places, or you switch your own office to, you know, clean and renewable energy sources, or if you work in a hospital or healthcare system. It's important to realize that when we talk about emitters, like, you know, the US as a country has emitted a lot of CO2, but the US healthcare industry, if you rank that alone as a country, would be a top 10 fossil fuel emitter. So every doctor is part of the healthcare industry. You could look at ways to, you know, green your office, investigate sustainable healthcare. And there are many organizations that do this. The AAD is partnered with something called My Green Doctor. There's a lot of tips and tricks on cost neutral or cost savings, sustainability and healthcare measures that people can implement. But really it's to make this an issue that people care about. So this can't be like everyone's like, someone else will take care of it, or it's the, I know it's important, but I don't know what to do. It should be, hey, when the American Academy of Dermatology supports something legislatively, that this is part of it, or that when SkinPAC donates to someone, that this is something that's weighed heavily as, you know, are you going to make the right decisions from an environmental standpoint, which we know impacts the health and safety, not just of our planet, but of our people and our patients and, you know, our dermatologists, our field, everything.
Up next, we feature an interview with Dr. Mark Lebwohl. Wallman Professor and Chair of the Department of Dermatology at the Inca School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, and Dermatology Times Editorial Advisory Board Member. Dr. Lebwohl discusses his presentation at AAD VMX 2021 about new research in biologics for the treatment of psoriasis.
So I know you talked a lot about specific drugs. You know, could you just give us a quick synopsis about your portion of the Hot Topics presentation at this year's AAD virtual meeting?
Sure. What I did at the meeting was I went over new developments in every single biologic that we have for psoriasis. And even some of the older drugs that we have new developments. So for example, we now have treatments that were very effective in adults, very safe in adults, and we've now expanded the indications for those treatments to include children. A few years ago, the only biologic we had approved for pediatric psoriasis, in fact, the only drug we had approved for pediatric psoriasis was etanercept. That came with some drawbacks. It had black box warnings about malignancy and infection. And the injections for of etanercept were given fairly often. We now have ustekinumab approved for pediatric age groups. We have several others either approved or on the way to approval with a tremendous amount of data being presented for pediatric psoriasis. Secukinumab is hopefully on the verge of approval. Ixekizumab is already approved. Adalimumab has excellent data. I don't know where they are in the approval process, but clearly is a drug that works well for pediatric psoriasis. So we've been able to expand the treatments available for children. So that's certainly one of the takeaways. And then I went through the whole list of biologics, and every single one of them has new information or information that's important to our audiences. And you could pick any of them out, and I can tell you what was new about them. We also have a couple of new biologics on the horizon that we should be getting hopefully soon.
And on that note, you know, what would you say are some of those top biologics in the pipeline right now?
So right now in the pipeline, the one that I believe will be approved first is bimekizumab. It's an IL-17A and IL-17F inhibitor. And until now, we've had secukinumab and ixekizumab, which block IL-17A, which is the most powerful IL-17 cytokine in terms of causing psoriasis, but the more prevalent cytokine is IL-17F. And so by being able to block not just IL-17A, but also IL-17F, we get yet a newer magnitude of improvement in psoriasis and also in psoriatic arthritis. We eagerly await bimekizumab's approval. There are also two new biologics on the horizon for pustular psoriasis, which is a debilitating an even life-threatening disease. We've never had any drug indicated for that disease. And we've relied on some of the other biologics or other psoriasis treatments, which are not reliably effective. Even some of the endpoints where Japan has approved drugs for pustular psoriasis, their endpoints is any improvement at all counts as a treatment success. You know, here we use improvements of 90% improvement in PASI score, 75% improvement, and they're talking about any improvement. So these are drugs where, their names are cisplatin and imsidolimab. And cisplatin for phase one data has been published, Cisplatin in the first week resulted in, I believe, if I remember correctly, 5 out of 7 patients achieving clear or almost clear in 1 week. By week 4, it was 100% of patients. in their phase one trial. So we have dramatically effective drugs coming that we didn't have before for pustular psoriasis.
That's some great news. Hopefully, you know, that can get developed further. My next question I have is, you know, in your opinion, how have biologics changed the treatment landscape for psoriasis?
We are finally at a point where we have so many highly effective and safe drugs that there is no excuse for a patient to live with bad psoriasis. We can treat anyone and dramatically improve their psoriasis and their quality of life.
And my last question here, you know, what would you say are your top three takeaways in your presentation that you think physicians should know?
I would say the top three messages are, first of all, we have a wide array of drugs. We use the term biologics and we tend to lump them together. And the problem with that is some of our older biologics did have boxed warnings about malignancy and infection. The new ones don't. They are quite safe. We even know that from people who are born with deficiencies of, for example, IL-17. They get yeast infections, and that's what we saw in the clinical trials. It was just monilial infections. They don't get other opportunistic infections. They don't get more malignancies. So we have drugs that are safe, and they're also extremely effective. And that would be my most important takeaway. We are now also are expanding the indications for those medications so that populations like children, women of childbearing potential, people with psoriatic arthritis, people with a variety of other comorbidities, we have different drugs that are ideal for each scenario. And that would be my second message. And my third message is that, you know, until bimekizumab is on the market, we actually never had a drug where at the primary endpoint, more than 50% of patients achieve PASI 100, literally not a dot of psoriasis left. And with bimekizumab, at its primary endpoint, the majority of patients achieve PASI 100. So when that comes out, we'll have a dramatically effective drug, and even more so, a dramatically effective treatment for psoriatic arthritis.
Thank you for listening to The Cutaneous Connection. For more coverage from AAD VMX 2021, you can visit www.dermatologytimes.com/conference/American Academy of Dermatology.